Thank you, Your Honor. And if I could please reserve just a couple of minutes on rebuttal.
Okay.
Wonderful. Thank you, Judge. So there are a couple of delineating factors about the pre-indictment exploration of attachment here that hasn't been before this court or the Supreme Court. One of them is neither court has explored the attachment of counsel pre-indictment in a non-investigative function of the government, so a prosecutorial function of the government. And we know that that's the case here for a couple of reasons. One is there was a target letter that said there was a potential resolution on the table, pre-indictment plea resolution, dealing with the United States sentencing guidelines and admissions of guilt and factual admissions. And we know that they intended to prosecute because 5 days after Mr. Olson's counsel below said no on his behalf to the offer, 5 days later, the indictment was returned. So we knew, and the government had mentioned exactly which charges were going to be coming in communications with counsel pre-indictment. So we know that the proposed indictment was at least prepared, and the government knew which charges were coming, and there was discussion with guidelines calculations with counsel below ahead of time. And so for these reasons, we know that the investigative phase had ended and the prosecutorial phase had begun. So that kind of fact pattern has yet to be before this court or the United States Supreme Court. The other difference is never before this court or the Supreme Court has the court looked at a pre-indictment guilty plea resolution proposal post-Lafler. So every time that this court has considered this set of facts and the United States Supreme Court has considered this set of facts, the Sixth Amendment right to counsel had not yet attached explicitly to the guilty plea process. So there's a competition between two constitutional scenarios here. We have, on the one hand, the criticality of the proceeding, and then on the other hand, attachment. Well,
Counsel, can I ask you a question? What, in your view, did we mean when we said bright line rule?
I think...
That mean there's holes in it?
I wouldn't use the word holes. I think that's a loaded term. But both this court and the United States Supreme Court always, when discussing a bright line rule, the phrase after that is always the initiation of criminal proceedings. And then there's always this four-factor investigation by the court of investigative versus prosecutorial function, the government's commitment to prosecution, whether or not the individual is facing expert adversary, and whether it's a critical stage of the proceeding. So I turn to the sister circuit, the Sixth Circuit's dissent, where they say, yes, courts are always throwing this term bright line around, but in the very same paragraph, often in the same sentence, they say the bright line is the commencement of criminal proceedings, which then there's an appositive that lists out preliminary hearing, arraignment, indictment. And it never just stops there. And that's what was so curious to the dissent in the Sixth Circuit Turner case was the analysis that could just be a full stop. Has this individual been arraigned, undergone a probable cause determination at preliminary hearing, or been indicted? And if the answer is no, then that should be the end of the analysis. But where the courts turn from the Supreme Court to the Sixth Circuit to this circuit is these four factors. The court is always reaching out to these four factors, all of which are met in flying colors here. And I will note that in Kirby and Gouveia, the two Supreme Court cases that we've been discussing at length in the briefs, there's kind of and I don't want to say an apology, but there's this phrase, this is not mere formalism. But the set of circumstances before this court with these four factors in mind and looking to the fact that the Supreme Court even runs through these four factors every single time, reduces the bright line to mere formalism if it is, in fact, has the guy been arraigned or gone through a preliminary hearing. Because we know here that literally the only reason the government was waiting to bring this indictment, which it did 5 days after Mr. Olson's counsel said no on his behalf to the negotiation, 5 days later, the indictment was returned. So in this instance, because the investigative function had completely stopped, there was even a discussion of discovery between Mr. Olson's counsel below and government counsel, the investigative function had completely stopped. If that bright line applies, in fact, not to the initiation of judicial proceedings as one could understand a plea agreement discussion, but rather arraignment, preliminary hearing, or indictment, that would reduce.
Well, let me ask you this. What did we mean when we say right to counsel attaches only after the initiation of formal charges?
My understanding is that the quote, well, I think when the government proposes a document by which one forfeits his right to trial, concedes illegal activity, and triggers a judgment of conviction, I would argue that that would fall within the analysis of whether or not a man is facing charges. I don't want to throw air quotes up in front of the Ninth Circuit, but certainly what's different about a proposed guilty plea agreement and, say, a photo lineup, one of them can certainly damage one's strength at trial or one's chances at trial. A photo lineup without counsel, that's certainly going to damage rights at trial.
Your time is going. Let me ask you one more question because I think I understand your line of argument here. But let me ask you this. He had counsel. And your position is that counsel was ineffective. But we have all this evidence in the record that counsel did notify him of the plea offer and took the position that couldn't do a plea until there were charges and had an idea of what the evidence was. Your client just says he wasn't notified of the offer. So what do you intend to show?
To take a hair and firmly split it, my position before the court is that he was entitled to have his habeas petition decided on the merits as opposed to as a matter of law. And I think that would entitle both Judge Wexler and Mr. Olson presenting evidence before the court so that it could be decided on the merits.
I have a couple of questions which are maybe more properly directed at your opponent, but in fact, he not only had counsel, but he had appointed counsel. And he had appointed counsel because, as I understand it, the U.S. attorney advised him to go to the office and get an appointed counsel. So I gather there is a practice of appointing counsel. Is that correct?
It is. And my day job is a trial lawyer. And I can advise that this is a very common practice. I stipulate to continue preliminary hearings pre-indictment all the time to reach negotiations. And I have the Bar Association imposes stringent ethical duties upon me, even in that pre-indictment situation, much like the government has an ethical duty not to propose a guilty plea agreement unless they actually intend on prosecuting.
But if you have a lawyer, the lawyer has ethical duties. That's not my question. The question is that it appears that the practice, at least in this district, is to appoint counsel once a target letter of this kind is sent. Is that accurate? That's what happened to him.
That is accurate, Your Honor.
And that's just so CJA lawyers are being paid even though there's no right to counsel? As I say, this may be a better question for your opponent, but it's something of an anomaly, it seems to me. If in fact there's no right to counsel.
And I would agree with Your Honor, and I would just add that it's generally only under these circumstances where there's a desire to resolve.
I see. Well, yes, but there's a, yes, well, there's a letter of this kind. All right, thank you.
Very good. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Appreciate that, Your Honor.
Yeah. Ms. Rouhani?
Good morning, Your Honors. Can you hear me?
We can. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Ellie Rouhani for the United States. Judge Berzon, I'd like to begin by answering your question. In the pre-indictment target letter process, a defendant or a proposed defendant would reach out to the clerk of the court, who would then refer them to the federal defender's office. That formal appointment process actually doesn't happen until the person appears in court, either at the time of the waiver of indictment and the entry of the information where counsel is formally appointed, or in the process of a complaint when they make their initial appearance. So that formal appointment process where counsel would start getting paid, if that's Your Honor's concern, doesn't actually happen until they appear before the court. And I think that that's part of the crux of the issue here, is that if there is a, as Mr. Hill suggests, some type of pre-indictment Sixth Amendment right to counsel, it really opens up this Pandora's box of problems. So what happens if a defendant decides to represent himself? Well, then how has he made a knowing and voluntary waiver? How can the court make that determination? How can he negotiate on his own behalf? Is there a Faretta process that would happen? And really, I think that is...
I mean, the answer, I suppose, is one can adjust the scope of the right to counsel to the circumstances. And in that regard, you're obviously in very good stead here because of these various sentences in Supreme Court opinions and in Hayes, but they didn't deal with the situation in which you have an essentially dispositive proceeding, which is going to preclude the trial so that and resolve the case. None of those cases deal with that. Is your position go to, when you say there's no right to counsel, you tend to be thinking about appointed counsel, but I guess you must mean no right to counsel at all. So the U.S. attorney could say, I'm not going to talk to you. If you say, well, I want you to talk to my retained counsel, the U.S. attorney could say, no, I won't. Is that right?
Hypothetically, yes, Your Honor. I think in this particular case, based upon the target letter that Mr. Pugh sent to Mr. Olson, it specifically indicated that his retained counsel could also reach out to Mr. Pugh.
No, I understand but to be have a consistent position, it has to be a position that there's no right to counsel. You could just avoid dealing with lawyers at all and insist on dealing with the individual. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, in the sense that if there is no Sixth Amendment right to counsel, that counsel would be an appointed counsel. I guess in the context of this case, if Mr. and I have to put it in the form of a hypothetical, Your Honor, to sort of delve into the question, is that if Mr. Olson had retained counsel in this case, Mr. Pugh had made, and we were in the same posture, but it was Ms. Wexler was retained counselor as opposed to being employed by the federal defender's office. The analysis wouldn't change because the right to counsel is really an attachment question. And so,
well, perhaps, well, but even you know, this is a very, if you don't mind me asking, I mean, this is really in an odd posture because most of the cases are whether or not the person had the right to counsel and he didn't have counsel.
Yeah.
So here he's got counsel. And now you're saying, well, but he has no right to effective counsel at this point. So that's a different question, I think.
Your Honor, and I think that this really gets into what the Supreme Court was talking about when they're talking about the difference in Rothgary, when they're talking about the difference between the critical stage of the proceeding. So, of course, during a critical stage of the proceedings, you're entitled to effective assistance. Well, that's a different question entirely than whether you have a right at all. So if he has no right at all, whether that person was effective or ineffective is really irrelevant. And that's, I think, what Judge Gordon was grappling with in the district court. He said that whether Ms. Wexler was effective or ineffective is irrelevant because he doesn't have a right to counsel, full stop. That's the bright line rule of the circuit. That's the interpretation that this court has taken of the Supreme Court authority. And so that's the end of the inquiry.
Is that there's an ethical obligation. I'm a little confused. But there's an ethical obligation to deal with counsel if someone is represented. You can't, the government can't say, I'm going to deal only with you and not with your counsel, that when he knows that he's represented. So I'm a little, I'm not quite sure I understand that. And there would be there could be malpractice, but that doesn't give rise if, when there's counsel does something wrong. But that may not give rise to a habeas.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And I think that you stated it much more eloquently than I did. And Judge Berzon, this is also to your point, is that if Mr. Olson had retained counsel, Mr. Pugh would have an ethical obligation to deal with that counsel. But that's different inquiry.
Excuse me. He could say, well, if you're going to have counsel on, that's it. There's no, I'm just withdrawing the offer because I don't want to deal with counsel, right?
Right.
I think based upon the target letter that was sent, I just don't see that as being a possibility in the scope of this particular case.
I'm trying to explore what the reach of your argument is.
Your Honor,
But there could be, I mean, the real problem here is invitation to manipulation, right? In other words, we know that if he had done the same thing the day after he filed the indictment rather than the day before, there would have been a right to effective counsel. And I don't have my feet in the ground sufficiently to know how whether this is since Lafler has become a more widespread practice, but there is obviously some incentive to create one, right? And the question is, do these sentences and these opinions encourage that manipulation of the system, essentially?
In a hypothetical world, yes, Your Honor, but it's my understanding that it's the Department of Justice's policy that we certainly advise defendants of their ability to seek out the counsel of somebody if they choose to. But I think that is a different question than whether the Sixth Amendment by itself recognizes that right to counsel.
Your real objection, and this was true in Lafler and its companion case as well, is to the ineffectiveness part. Your real concern is with applying the ineffectiveness part, not with him having a lawyer and you're dealing with a lawyer. Is that accurate?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm not understanding your question. Could you?
My question is, it appears that your real concern is, although you're asserting a very broad proposition, your concern is with the ineffectiveness possibility. Defending on a practical ground, at least, the notion that there shouldn't be counsel involved in these negotiations.
And let me clarify, Your Honor, do you mean in the context of this appeal, or do you mean generally counsel?
I mean, the problem here is that we have some sentences and some opinions which don't have anything to do with this particular circumstance, which are, if you read them on their face, preclusive. So therefore, we have to deal on a much higher level in this particular case. So I am talking more generally, i.e. say any form of pre-indictment negotiations. And also, I gather that you it's not only the negotiations, but putting the material on paper, the actual agreement as to which you say there's no right to counsel.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that stems directly from the text of the Sixth Amendment. So I think that what Your Honor is getting at is this sense of unease, I think, that comes out in dissents where there's this that there's a tension here. But in fact, a defendant may have rights under different amendments. He may have different rights under the due process clause. He may have different rights in the ethical apply both to prosecutors and the ethical rules that apply to the defense attorneys. And so I don't want there to be this impression that defendants are completely left to the wolves in this pre-indictment process. That's just not correct. They do have rights. It just doesn't arise under the Sixth Amendment.
I mean, what you're saying is it doesn't have a right of effective assistance of counsel.
Yes, I mean, I guess that I have to be saying that, because if there's no Sixth Amendment right to counsel, then it also flows that he has no right to pre-indictment.
Right. So then how do you deal with Rothbury, which says, you know, plea negotiations are a critical part of the criminal proceeding. And the government's position in this, and I understand where it derives, but it seems to be, you don't have a right to effective assistance of counsel during one of the most critical portions of the criminal proceedings, which seems a bit odd.
And Your Honor, I understand the position, but I think that is ultimately what was the confusion in Rothgary, which the Supreme Court specifically said that the defendant in that case made the mistake of confusing the critical stage question with the attachment question. Plea negotiations are a critical stage. That's under Missouri, under a long line of cases, and ultimately culminating in Missouri versus Frye. But ultimately, those questions have to be kept distinct. And that is the problem here, is that Mr. Olson wants to conflate those two. He wants to superimpose them. But the Supreme Court has said very clearly that that's an analytical mistake, that you have to keep the critical. It is a critical stage. We agree. But it's, the attachment doesn't occur.
It was in the opposite.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It was in the opposite direction in Rothgary, right? The problem there was that the right attached, but we're not saying it's critical, right? So they didn't say you could have a critical stage, but the right doesn't attach. It was the opposite, right?
Well, Rothgary dealt with the prosecutor not even being involved at that point. Right. That was a case where he was hailed.
Yes, the right attaches, but that doesn't determine whether it's a critical stage at which you have to have a lawyer. And you're arguing the opposite now. That you have a critical stage in which a lawyer is really essential to do anything sensible. It's potentially dispositive. I mean, unlike all the other cases which are investigatory, they may be helpful to have the lawyer, but here you're going to determine the case. And you're saying that it's, you're now saying it's critical, but the right doesn't attach.
I thought you were saying there's no case. I'm not quite sure how it can be a critical stage of a prosecution if there's been no prosecution yet.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. I think that, to be clear, is that plea negotiations, generally speaking, are a critical stage of the proceedings. And I think that, but the Supreme Court hasn't sort of grappled with this issue. The Sixth Circuit has on multiple occasions, and the Supreme Court has denied cert and let it stand. And I think that part of it is because of the can of worms that you open up if you ultimately say that there is a Sixth Amendment right to counsel pre-indictment. And that's what this court was getting at in Hayes, is that in that case, the government actually used a trial mechanism to hail the defendant into court. And even then, this court said, that's not sufficient because he may never have been indicted. And in fact, Mr. Olson might not have been indicted. If the grand jury returned a no true bill, Mr. Olson was free and clear. So I think if you're thinking about what is the critical stage, it's a critical stage of some type of adverse judicial process. There was no judicial process at all during this pre-indictment negotiation. Your Honors, I see that I'm well over my time. I'm happy to answer any additional questions. Thank you. We would ask that you affirm the district court's decision.
And 3 minutes for rebuttal to equalize the time.
Hi, Judge. Just one moment. I've lost connection through my VPN. If you could just give me one moment, I'm going to fix this. I'm so sorry.
Olivia, this is Kwame. I've got clock control. What do you need done?
Thank you. Go ahead, Judge Thomas. I'm sorry.
You need to put 3 minutes on, Kwame. There we go. Mr. Hill, you may proceed with your rebuttal. I'm afraid you're muted.
Thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to seize upon something that Judge Berzon said in relation to a question that Judge Schroeder posed the government, which is that there weren't any proceedings or there wasn't a prosecution underway here. And what I want to impress upon the court and what makes this situation so unique as opposed to those investigative functions that courts have analyzed before is had he signed that agreement that was proposed pre-indictment that would have convicted him of 4 felonies and given him a total offense level of 21, which I think he was a category 1, and would have disposed of any need for prosecution because he would have waived his right to an appeal, waived his right to a trial, been convicted, and conceded factual guilt without any Sixth Amendment rights whatsoever. That's what makes this case different than, say, a photo lineup.
Not exactly, or, right. Is it because there would have been a Rule 11 colloquy anyway, right? Would there not be? Because there was never a prosecution.
Yeah.
Must be.
Well, yeah, there would have had to have been a colloquy, correct?
There would have still have to have been an indictment, right? Or not an indictment, a complaint, and there would have had to be a Rule 11 colloquy. So there was some check on the system.
True, and it probably would have been an information, right, and a colloquy. However, the terms of that agreement would have been no longer subject to change. I mean, certainly he could have.
The court disapproved him. Unless he got up there and said, you know, I didn't have a lawyer, I didn't know what I was doing, you should disapprove it.
Right. In which case, now he's been charged, and if the government is to be believed in this case, the posture of negotiations would have forever changed. And in fact, they did. He ended up with a higher total offense level post-charge. So, yes, there would be a colloquy. But if it falls apart in that colloquy, now the negotiation phase has passed, pre-indictment, and the posture of that negotiation is going to change substantially, like it did here. So not to mention, if he does withdraw a plea, he signed it. Those are admissible against him should he testify at trial. So it's still going to be factual admissions to criminal conduct that occurred without any aid of counsel, and they're going to touch exactly upon the elements of what the government would have to prove at trial, because it would have been a guilty plea agreement on ostensibly one of the charges that would come down through an indictment later on. So I think
any idea how widespread this practice is and whether it has increased since Loeffler and its companion case.
Anecdotally, what I can tell the court is, although the majority of my practice is privately retained, on a number of occasions, either for grand jury subpoena or for pre-plea negotiations, I have been appointed and remunerated by the CJA program. That's the best I can do, Your Honors. And with that, I appreciate your time and attention, and I will submit it.
Thank you both for your arguments today. The case just argued will be submitted for decision, and we will proceed with the argument in the next case.